That was a funny one. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Ted Snyder, regular writer for antiwar.com, is going to be on the show to talk about the Islamic State. Sandy Tolan is the author of a great article running at Tom Dispatch about the history, the semi-recent history of Israel's relationship with Palestine, and particularly with Hamas and the prisoners of the Gaza Strip. So, really great article there by Sandy Tolan. We'll be running it on Anti... In fact, we'll be running both of their articles tomorrow as originals on antiwar.com. And, I don't know, man. I got an invite out to Bamford, but I haven't heard back from him yet. I think I need to go digging around and try to find some other phone numbers for him to call. But he's got a brand new story out all about Edward Snowden. Bamford went and interviewed him in Moscow and has, breaks a new story about NSA technology and how it's being used in there. It's at Wired.com. I'm trying to get Jim back on the show today. But, I wanted to hear this anyway. And I want to see if I can hunt down more phone numbers for Jim. So here's Ron Paul being interviewed on RT about Iraq.
Military action in the country and its implications. Earlier, I spoke with former Texas Congressman Ron Paul. I first asked him about the latest developments and the arming of Kurdish militants.
Well, I think it's a little bit late to try to salvage all the mistakes that we've made for the past 24 years. I've been opposed to going into Iraq all the way back to the beginning in 1990 because I believe in non-intervention, that we should mind our own business, and it never works out very well. So in spite of the problems and the obvious people suffering from this, it's a consequence of us being in there. And I don't think the solution is being involved even more so once again and renew all the efforts, because I'm afraid it will end up with a lot more violence because they're putting more troops in there right now. So I think the policy that we should follow is one designed to allow the Iraqis to solve all their problems and stay out of this, let them deal with it, because we've tried for a long time, we've lost a lot of lives, spent a lot of money, and we've allowed a mess to develop, and it's nothing but a mess and chaos there, and in a way we're partially responsible for that.
Mm-hmm. And seeing the way ISIS has operated so far, do you think the Kurds are even capable of taking ISIS on at this point?
Well, you know, the Kurds have always had this reputation of being great fighters and that they're very good at it. And I would think that they're quite capable of doing this. I'm surprised that they haven't retaliated a little bit better. But one of the reasons why they haven't done very well is that ISIS ended up getting a lot of weapons from us. And they've captured weapons. They've got them out of Syria. And I'm sure there's some that came from Libya. So they're well armed. So we haven't done the Kurds any favor whatsoever. So it would have been much better, of course, when the whole crisis started in the early part of this century, is just allow the Kurds to have their own country, and by now they would be in much better shape. But I think our policies indirected has made it very difficult for the Kurds to defend themselves, because their enemies are well armed with American weapons.
And in the case of Syria, we saw the U.S. struggle quite a bit as they tried to decipher exactly who to arm within the opposition. And as a result, some of those weapons fell into the wrong hands. In the case of Iraq, the U.S. is arming a much more organized Kurdish force. Do you think there's still concern that weapons could really fall into the wrong hands here?
Absolutely. That's always the possibility. The intentions are always good. But there's always the danger of this happening. So I would stick to the basic principle that we have a strong national defense. We defend our national security. We don't get involved in fights around the world. We don't get involved with civil strife and civil wars, and especially what was going on in the Middle East. So, no, I think the argument stands on its own merit. Harris that we shouldn't be involved in doing this, you might say, well, yeah, but the Kurds are a lot better people to support than, say, the unidentifiable groups of rebels that were in Syria, which is quite possibly be the case. But I think if we'd have stayed out of Iraq, the whole world would be a lot better off, and I think the Kurds would be a lot better off as well.
Well, the Obama administration says it must act in order to protect American personnel and diplomats stationed at the U.S. consulate in Erbil. If the city falls to Islamic militants, ISIS could have, of course, theoretically progress even further. Under that logic, do you agree that some kind of military action is needed?
Yeah, we should send in an airplane and bring them out. Because it's a war zone, and why look for some disaster to happen like it did in Libya, you know, and our ambassador getting killed? So I would say, yes, a military has a responsibility to retreat when they need to, and it's a fight that we have lost. I think we have spent too much, and look, I lived through the time and was in the military during the Vietnam War, and what a disaster that was, and it ended up with a retreat. And look how much better off Vietnam is today, because we just flat out left after we and the French have done such harm to the Vietnamese. So I think the sooner we get out of there, the better. We don't have a moral responsibility. We don't have a constitutional responsibility. It has nothing to do with our national security. It jeopardizes our national security, and it's bankrupting our country. And this is exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted. He wanted to engage us over there because he says, I'll bring you down like I brought the Soviets down, because we'll take you to bankruptcy. And we're doing the same thing because we flat out can't afford it. It's a failed policy. I think after so many years and so many decades, we ought to admit the truth.
So you believe there's no moral obligation whatsoever on the part of the U.S. to go back in there?
Not as a government. I think people who are interested and they want to donate money and send the Red Cross over there to help people, I think that's very legitimate. But no, I do not believe that we have any moral responsibility to pack up, send more troops over there. Every day you read about more military going in. And of course, they said we don't want to have boots on the ground. Well, we never got rid of the boots on the ground. We had special forces and the CIA and others involved, very much involved, always prepared to go back in. So no, I think it's a bad
right.
situation, and we do not have this obligation.
You did mention boots on the ground. You know, in the past, President Obama has said that combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq. He's made that clear several times. Yet at the same time, we've heard the Obama administration say no option is off the table when it comes to military involvement. Do you think President Obama will stick to his word, or is this essentially mission creep as you see it?
Well, of course it is. That's the way both administrations have run things. There's always mission creep. And, of course, the Republicans, the hawkish Republicans now are hysterical that he's not bombing and killing and sending more troops in faster, even with all these failures. It's unbelievable. When are they ever going to quit and say, hey, maybe our policies are wrong? And yet we continue to do the same thing over and over again. So, yes, I think there will be mission creep. I think it's already there. I think we never really left Iraq. And now we're building up the troops again. And who knows what the unforeseen consequences will be. It may get worse before it gets better. And then we're going to have to send a lot more personnel in. And besides, using bombers and using drone missiles, it's an act of war. We're committing war. And innocent people die. Look how many innocent people have died at the hands of our drone bombs. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, this same thing will happen again, and there will be a lot of unintended consequences, and it certainly will be an expected consequence when it will drive us further into bankruptcy.
And then, of course, there's the public opinion aspect of this. Now, according to a recent AP poll, 78% of Americans think that history will judge the Iraqi war as a failure. And most say the U.S. was right to withdraw American troops from the country in 2011. Where do you think American public opinion stands on this latest retreat back into Iraq? Do you think there are any Americans that believe we should go back in?
Yeah, I do, and I think, unfortunately, I think the numbers are going to grow.
We'll be right back, y'all.
What you have to do is describe...
It's the Skullhorn Show. You know, that's Ron Paul on RT. You can find it at libertycrier.com.
The way they act.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my stuff there. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Let me play the last little bit of that Ron Paul interview for you.
Stands on this latest retreat back into Iraq. Do you think there are any Americans that believe we should go back in?
Yeah, I do. And I think, unfortunately, I think the numbers are going to grow because all you have to do is describe, ISIS and the ruthlessness of the way they act. But, you know, that's all a facade, too, that we have to go in and rescue, the tragedy that is happening in northern Iraq. But what about when all the Christians were run out of Iraq when we were in charge of the government? There was no concern. How about the people who are suffering from war in Gaza? Is everybody rushing there and say there's a humanitarian concern? What about the people in eastern Ukraine? We're actually trying to stop Russia from sending in some help. At the same time, we're trying to obstruct it from coming in. And, of course, that to me, I think they're pure hypocrites on which crisis they want to attend to. And I think what we're seeing down around Iraq and all the war that's been going on for all these years has a lot to do with oil, quite frankly. And right now it has to do with oil and probably rescuing our military personnel. But we're digging a bigger hole for ourselves, which we've been doing for decades.
That was former Texas Congressman Ron Paul.
Oh, yeah, it was. You know,
and now to the latest in Iraq,
no.
U.S.
So, yeah, hey, man, wasn't that great? I love Ron Paul, man. I was arguing with Justin last night, Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com about Rand Paul, because even though Justin wrote kind of an anti-Rand thing, I'm even more anti, and Justin still likes him somehow. And what I was saying about Ron was, and Justin was saying, you know, I think the people who just can't stand Rand are just sectarians. And, but you know what? Then how do you explain the fact that I worship Ron Paul? That I hold, erase really all those faces on Mount Rushmore, put Indians up there, I guess, or whatever, bears or animals they wanted to worship or whatever. But maybe put Ron's face up there. He's the greatest parliamentarian in world history. And now here he is, even a couple of years out of power, and blam, he's still just going strong. And then did you hear him at the end there? Oh, you care so much about humanitarianism, huh? Well, what about the people of Gaza? What about the people of East Ukraine? Yeah, that's my man right there. The heroic Ron Paul. And in fact, check out in the background as he's talking, you can find this again at Liberty Crier. It's Voices of Liberty. I'm on there now. VoicesOfLiberty.com. And in fact, it's funny, because, there's some truthers who say that I'm a CIA agent or a Mossad agent or, ooh, the $100 a month that the Future Freedom Foundation pays me. Oh, it's the foundation ATM. Scott's living the good life off of something called a foundation. Oh, he's so rich, and that's why he's not a stupid, retarded, know-nothing truther idiot. It's the only explanation, because he's so rich. But you know what the truth is? I realized this week that, because I just come from pirate radio. I could just sit up there and talk about sodomy all night long on my show if that's what I wanted to do. I've never, until this week, have I had any kind of incentive that I had to consider at all to not say exactly what I want. I guess I take that back. The other incentive I've had has been, I'm afraid of the police. But it doesn't really stop me. I talk, I try to convince people to hate all cops as much as I hate them anyway, every day. And I admit that I'm afraid to do it, but I just do it anyway because I can't help it. Because they're the worst criminals in our society. That's why. Because they are lawless. And that's an incentive for me to be careful about which battles I pick and which fights I say and whatever. But I do it anyway. But as far as, like, friends, as far as, and not that the Voices of Liberty is paying me a cent or anything, which is fine. I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying, not that I work for them or anything. But this is actually the first time that I've thought to myself, man, maybe I shouldn't say what I want to say about Rand Paul because I'm afraid his dad won't like me anymore. And now, even that, I'll get kicked off of the awesome new thing that they let me be a part of. That's what a sellout I am. And then I went on and attacked him all over Twitter for 3 days in a row anyway. And attacked him on this show anyway. Because, you know, I'm an honest guy. But that is actually, literally, despite any ridiculous fantasy about me working for the CIA, because I interview Phil Giraldi all the time. Yeah, okay. Good thinking. Despite all that, this is actually the most compromised I've ever been in my life. The most compromised I've ever been in my life. They're running my interviews, some of them, at Voices for Liberty. And I'm afraid I'll get kicked off of there if I say bad things about Rand, but then I say them anyway. Like, for example, if you go look at my Twitter feed, it's all full of how he's a bad person, okay? He is not a good person. And that's why he keeps doing terrible things. That's why he lies like he's drinking a cup of water. That's why he's going to keep lying and keep doing terrible things. He's not a decent man. That's his fatal flaw. And I've been saying that since I first talked to him in 2009, nonstop, ever since then. Go back and look at my Facebook page and whatever if you want. From back then. I interviewed him in 2009. I could tell right away. This guy is not cool, man. This guy will surrender anything for his ambition. And you hear how easy it is for his father to just say, look, man, here, let me count the reasons why. He doesn't just say, no, because I'm a cranky old man and I don't want to have a war, even though war is the wave of the future. It goes, blah, blah, blah. No, he's got as good arguments as anybody and good as hell enough for me, that's for sure, for staying out of the war. Of course, he's got to tell it on Russian TV because they won't have Ron Paul on C-SPAN or on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. Nobody's interviewing Ron Paul about Iraq right now. Can you imagine that? One of the five Republicans in the House who voted against the Iraq war last time, who was against it all along and who was awesome on it all along. And they won't have him on TV. He's got to go on Russian TV to say this stuff. And you see, this is what really sticks in my craw about Rand Paul. All he has to do is just be honest and win. When they say, oh my God, your father said this, can you defend that? Which they're going to never stop doing. Instead of saying, no, here, let me throw him under the bus for you again, media. He should just defend his father's position because his father is a hell of a lot more right than he is. And the American people have already come around to his father's point of view. 78% of the American people say the Iraq war was a total failure, never should have happened. So all Rand Paul has to do is be honest, and that's how to win. That's how to satisfy his ambition. Oh yeah, anyway, the point was, so I'm compromised, you see. I won't say what I really think because I have this incentive not to. Because I'm corrupt. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Jonathan Schwartz from Tiny Revolution just tweeted out a picture of Diem, Ngoho Dien, Din Diem, go, I don't know, DM, that's his name, DM. With his head separated from his shoulders, laying on the ground, it says, breaking White House emails, Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki, encouraging photo of former U.S. puppet DM. Yeah, boy, you better run like hell, Nouri al-Maliki. Hey, you done good. You put a lot of drills through the skulls of a lot of Sunnis for George W. Bush. And so you've earned your money and your ski vacation in Switzerland. You better run before they put a bullet in your head. That's how America does business. Henry Kissinger joked that, oh yeah, you're way better off being an enemy of America than our friend. Much more likely to stab you in the back or, you know, shoot you in the head to death. Yeah. True story. Yeah. All right, Ted Snyder's coming up on the show here in just a little while. We're going to talk about the history of ISIS and just who's zooming who here and what for. But yeah, so I got a new pet peeve, which is the guys at McClatchy keep completely rewriting Mitchell Prothero's stories as the hours go by, sometimes including rewriting the headline. Instead of letting a new story come out, they go and rewrite the old story, and old stuff disappears that was useful. Even if it's outdated, fine, so publish a new damn story then. So they keep rewriting the hell out of all of his articles, so I don't know how to tell you to find any of them. And that it's funny because it's not just at McClatchy, it's at the Sacramento Bee and the Miami Herald and the few other internet sites where they reprint McClatchy's stories there. They keep doing this, and it's really pissing me off, and it makes it hard for me to use them as footnotes to tell you what I want to tell you. But anyway, one of the stories here is... like the story yesterday we talked about, maybe it's the first version of the same story that we talked about with Mitchell Prothero on the show yesterday, but it was later followed up. And the follow-up was about Iran and how it is Iran just as much as America that is insisting that Maliki step down, including a quote, I forget now if it was directly from the Iranian president. It wasn't from the Ayatollah. But it was either the president or his right-hand Smithers, you know, spokesman guy, who said that, I guess people don't watch The Simpsons anymore, and Smithers is now a dated reference from my childhood, sorry. But anyway, the Iranian government said, yeah, Maliki beat it, pal. So, just so nobody's confused, and I'm not trying to demonize this, you know, in and of itself in the microcosm, but just so that you understand... it's America and Iran together again, working in Iraq to choose which member of the United Iraqi Alliance of the Shiite parties will become the next prime minister. This is the same story that's been happening since they worked together to write the Constitution of 2004 and hold the Purple Finger election of 2005 and then wage the civil war necessary to enforce the results of that election of 2005 and kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and give it to the Shiites. And so here we are working again. Don't let them lie to you about you know, what's going on, who's zooming here, and what the hell. And what's fun, too, is just wait a little while, and Ted Snyder's going to be on the show, and I'll go ahead and ruin it for you. Ted Snyder's going to be on about how America's been backing ISIS all this time because that's what Israel wants, to hurt Iran. In fact, that's what a lot of Americans want, to hurt Iran. So, and he's right, too. But there you go. So that's America's policy. It's a hell of a thing. And you know what? I'm going to let Ted Snyder have his say. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. I want to get back to something Ron Paul was saying there. Ron Paul said a lot of good stuff there. One of the things that he said was that Al-Qaeda's plan for America was to bait us into overreacting, getting bogged down in wars over there, and bleeding us to bankruptcy and destroying our empire the way they destroyed the Soviet Union. And... he's right about that. And that's sort of the all-important point that you understand here. You know, and I've been over this with Michael Scheuer and others in the past, but I think you could understand. It's pretty simple. In fact, you could probably hear me not interviewing, but lecturing poor Alex Kane on the show about this last week. That terrorism is all about the reaction. You know, I already kind of knew this because I've been reading the John Birch stuff for a while, but the number one greatest John Bircher ever was William Norman Grigg, the guy Will Grigg, our friend that we interviewed yesterday about the police state in Ferguson, who is now a purist libertarian and not very conservative. I mean, he's personally conservative, but politically he's not anymore. They ran him out of the John Birchers because he's too good on the Mexican issue and the immigration issue, and they decided, you know, to be right wing on it and whatever. But anyway, I used to read the New American Magazine all the time, and right after September 11th, their first issue was, look at all the civilian and firefighter and local police heroes who risked their lives to save people that day. And then their next issue was, did the government know what was coming? And in there, Will Grigg broke the story for the first time ever on his FBI source. For the first time anyone ever read it, it was in the New American Magazine in the fall of 2001 that the August 6th presidential daily briefing was titled Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States. You go read it yourself. But anyway, the thing about Will Grigg is he's willing to ask those questions, but he's not some kook. And he actually is a scholar and knows world history better than probably any of us. And, you know, knows what the hell is going on. And in fact, the Birchers have had kind of a thing stuck in their craw about Islamist terrorism ever since the first World Trade Center bombing. And you might call them horrible right-wingers that you don't like or whatever, but the point is that they're outside the mainstream enough that they took a real interest in who are these guys and what are they up to. And anyway, so, and also, of course, they're experts on the Reds. Going back into the days of the Cold War and domestic communist terrorism. So, sorry. I'm just trying to tell you, I read Will Grigg in the fall of 2001, right after September 11th, say, hey, everybody, here's what you need to understand. With terrorism, the action is in the reaction. So, your first choice is to wake up, man, and do what they want. Stop doing the thing that made them want to do what they did to you. So, occupying Saudi Arabia, as Paul Wolfowitz would recommend, let's go ahead and get our bases out of Saudi Arabia, because that is driving Bin Laden's recruitment. Thank you, Paul Wolfowitz, for admitting that Ron Paul and Michael Schreuer are right about that. So that's part of it, right? Stop backing the Israelis, not on your life. But you could either, your choices are either give in to their demands as the result of the terrorist attack against you, or more likely and understood by the person doing the attack, you're going to overreact, which is just as well. And, you know, the great journalist Anand Gopal talked about on the show about a letter from Bin Laden to Mullah Omar after the Americans invaded in 01, saying, I'm sorry for getting you into this, Mullah Omar, and getting your government overthrown, and the Americans' reaction is a bit more brutal than I assumed. However, just wait 10 years, man. Just wait 10 years, and you'll see it was worth it, right? So he doesn't care about collateral damage. He doesn't care about dead Afghan civilians any more than he cared about dead American civilians. It's all, he's like a communist collectivist. It's all making omelets out of broken eggs. And so that was his policy. And then, as Michael Schreuer says, former chief of the Bin Laden unit, Iraq, etc., 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 Libya, Syria, etc., etc., all this intervention, that's all the hoped for but unexpected gift to Bin Laden. To do exactly what he meant to do, what he said he was doing in the first place before 9/11, and what he explained after, which is trying to get the Americans to bleed to death, literally and financially, in the sands of the Middle East until we finally back off. Since, after all, we are from the middle part of North America, not Arabia. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This here's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's fundraising week here at The Scott Horton Show. And I try not to do this very often at all. And I understand that everybody is pretty much in the same damn position as me as far as not having much money. But, you know, if a whole lot of you chip in a whole lot, then wouldn't that be a whole lot? But if a whole lot of you chipped in a little bit, that'd be awesome. And, well, anyway. I ain't gonna lie to you, and I'm not trying to just threaten you, you know, lying to you along these lines. But the honest truth is, I may have to quit doing this here pretty soon. Because I need to be able to make a lot more money. More than anything, I need advertisers on the show is what I need. But donations to make sure the show can keep going until I can sign up some more advertisers, that would be great. And, you know, there are about six wars going on now, so it seems like somebody's got to be doing anti-war radio. And so, I don't know, maybe there's somebody better and I should get out of their way, but let me know. Otherwise, if you want there to be a show, donate. Thank you. ScottHorton.org/donate. Okay, cool. Now, anyway, man, you know what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to probably see if I can get... Oh, I'm still trying to get James Bamford about Snowden, but I'm going to see if I could probably get Jason at 1:30 or 2 Eastern re Ukraine. And see, that was an instant message to Eric Garris there. See if I can get Jason Ditz from antiwar.com to talk about Ukraine. I admit I have not been doing a good enough job harvesting Ukraine guests. But then again, we got Jason. He knows what's going on. So anyway, see if we can do that later in the show. Ted Snyder's going to be on about ISIS, like I say. And then also Sandy Tolan wrote this great thing about Gaza and the history of Gaza since Hamas was elected in 2005 in the elections that Condoleezza Rice and Ehud Olmert held and basically ensured that they would win. Anyway, so great piece there. And I'm going to try really hard to keep my mouth shut and just let Sandy tell the tale here. Well, I really want to focus on the time between the election and the outright siege. And, you know, which of course is all Hamas's fault, according to the talking points. But I'm pretty sure that that's not what Sandy Tolan says. I was trying to get Emily Hauser on the show. I thought, didn't she follow me on Twitter? But I checked and the answer was no. And I thought, you know, maybe I had offended her with my harsh language. And she doesn't like me. So I think we had tweeted back and forth a couple times, but that was a while back. Anyway, she had written a thing where she really talked in detail about that post-2005-2006 era. It's all important because it's a major talking point of the Israelis. Oh, we gave them full independence in 2005, and instead they just shot their bottle rockets at poor little us. That's a major piece of the Israeli government's public relations. And of course, it's a ridiculous lie. Don't be stupid. Don't think that the Israeli government said a thing and that that thing was true. Don't be an idiot. You're better off driving drunk. Anyway, so Sandy Tolan is going to set us straight on a little bit of the history there going on there. Sure as I am, says he's round. Okay, cool. Okay, good. And then... Oh, so I can save Ukraine till Jason. Let me say a couple things here real quick, and I'm going to get back to Iraq. We're going to have open time. I'm going to get back to Iraq and Gaza, too. I want to get to Ferguson. Well, you know what? Let me pick up where I was actually leaving off on the other side of that break about America's government reacting exactly the way bin Laden wanted, especially if you read his speech of 2004. He mocks the Americans for letting George Bush and his politically connected companies benefit from this war while everyone else suffers. We all suffer, the Iraqis suffer, everybody suffers. And he's saying, now this is my plan, and you guys are falling for it, but you could just stop. You know, for an evil baby-killing murderer, he's kind of had a thing about him where a little bit of sportsmanship there where like, hey, you know, you get your troops out of our land and off of our property and we'll stop killing you. Not that he necessarily meant it. I'm saying he is an evil murderer or whatever, but the way that he dressed Americans in that speech was like, hey, listen, let me let you in on a little secret that George Bush ain't telling you, all right? You are being exploited for my benefit and his. Get it? Knock it off, you dummies. Right? It's like helpful advice. And anyway, another part of, and I forget now if this is, I think this goes back a ways. This is not the 2004 speech where bin Laden said he wanted the Americans to experience the, quote, choking life of the American police state that he knew would be the natural result of the September 11th attack and hoped would be the result of all the attacks leading up to it. In fact, did help get the Anti-Terrorism Act of 96 passed in a way. But anyway, so, he said, and again, this is part of the action is in the reaction, because he figures if September 11th only gets the American people to back their government and doubling down on the empire and spending all their money, that might take a while. Maybe another way we can get them to overreact in a way that is against their own interests, in a way that they'll eventually rebel against, will be to create a police state in America. Because everyone will be hysterical and demand that government do everything to protect them, and government will be more than happy to take them up on that and institute a Homeland Security National Police State, which is what we see going on in Ferguson right now, where not only do we have cops with billy clubs breaking black people's skulls open, they're driving around in military gear because of Homeland Security. Gave them all the stuff because the war on terrorism created the pressure for the Pentagon to just give all of their surplus. And, you know, they don't buy what they need. They buy whatever is politically right because it's not their money. So whatever is extra, which is a lot, they just give to all the cops. And then the cops all dress up as soldiers and immediately they feel like soldiers. And then their job is putting down the American insurgency. And then there you go. And that could be you. If you look at a cop funny, then you're a Fallujah insurgent and he has the right to blow your head off. That's the choking life he was talking about. Not just taking your shoes off at the airport, but even worse. So that eventually Americans will choose, assuming they have the right information, that like, well, wait a minute. So what you're saying is if we just quit allowing our government to massacre people over there in the Middle East all the time, if we just quit paying the Israelis to massacre people over there in the Middle East all the time, then we wouldn't have to take off our shoes at the airport? Then we could dress our cops back in blouses instead of military fatigues? Then we could be anything like a normal country in a normal time again? Okay. And that sounds like a good deal to me. It actually is the deal. And yeah, there are some incorrigible threats that, you know, you would hope that, you know, probably more the European police could keep from getting on planes to come over here. But anyway, and the strategy works perfectly as long as you're a banker or you are an arms industrialist or you're a member of the Israeli government or their Amen Corner here in the United States. As long as you're a stockholder in General Dynamics or Raytheon, or of course, first and foremost, Lockheed, then it's for you. But for the rest of us, it's all at our detriment. And, you know, the Islamic State, they've got their hands full with their enemies right now, big time. But the American politicians, it's like they'll do everything they can just to make bin Laden's magic wishes come true. All the truthers say that bin Laden worked for America all along, or Israel, or whatever. I say America worked for bin Laden. And Bush and Cheney, Obama and Hillary and John McCain and all these guys are actually secret agents of Al-Qaeda. And their job is to drive America into the ground because they're traitors. That makes a lot more sense than the other way around, really. I mean, if you assume that people in Eurasia can actually be human beings and not just automatons of the CIA, but that they have brains and motivations and money to do things that they want to do too. Anyway, so there you go. Ferguson, more on Ferguson, more on Iraq and on Gaza and Ukraine and everything later in the show. Stay tuned. Still trying to get Bamford. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org and libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. Our first guest today is Ted Snyder. He's a regular contributor to antiwar.com. And, well, first of all, welcome back to the show, Ted. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks, Scott.
Good. Very happy to talk to you again. So this new article, we're running it tomorrow, The American Response to ISIS. They're patterns, not coincidences. All right, so you seem to think there's some kind of coherent thinking behind American foreign policy. It can't possibly be right. But wait, before we get to that, no, I'm just kidding. Before we get to that, though, I just wanted to give the, you know, catch people up the latest headlines here. We got airstrikes so far, all still up in the north as far as we're being told. We have a transition of power where Maliki is, being pushed out, but in favor of a new Dawa Party candidate to be the prime minister. And we have headlines coming out that they're considering a rescue operation, which presumably would be fleets of Black Hawks, I guess, to try to get the Yazidis all safely into safe regions of Kurdistan, etc. like that. So that's, and Obama, of course, has said this is not going to be over in weeks and left the door open to, widespread intervention. You know, he says he doesn't want much intervention. He has said we're going to deny ISIS a safe haven. So that sounds like a pretty blank check that he can write himself. That's where we're at today. But so this article is, catching us up on the history of how it was that we got here. And certainly everything that happened that the CIA, the State Department, the National Security Council, the president decided to do on this, the military, everything they've done was deliberate. But I guess we'll see whether there's a kind of grand strategy to it all or what it is exactly. Think about that. Now I'll finally be quiet and give you free rein to explain your position here, Ted.
Okay, Scott, thanks. I found the thing going on with ISIS to be mystifying in a number of ways. And the first thing that kept surprising me was America's silence on the whole advance of ISIS. You would think that in a region where they're trying, the war on terror to try to stop groups like Al-Qaeda from advancing, you'd think that as ISIS was advancing, that would be the number one concern for America. And yet Obama maintained this incredible silence while ISIS advanced. So that was kind of surprising. And then all of a sudden, there's reversal of policy and America's intervening. And so for me, the two really big questions were, why was America silent as ISIS advanced? And then why did America suddenly stop being silent as ISIS advanced? And there was a lot of discussions of a lot of sort of coincidences. And what occurred to me is that the coincidences were coincidences. They were patterns. And that if you looked at the patterns, you could find a consistent pattern in American foreign policy that's not so different from the patterns in American foreign policy we've seen for decades. So the first pattern that I thought, which wasn't a coincidence, is why is America silent while ISIS advances? And I thought the way to answer the question of why America's silent while they advance is to look at where they're advancing. And if you look at where they're advancing through Syria and Iraq, and now Robert Fisk has reported recently into Lebanon. But that's not a coincidence, it's a pattern, right? If you look at Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, you see precisely Iran's three greatest allies in the region. And I don't think that's a coincidence. It means that the ISIS advance is completely coincident with America's foreign policy interests. they've been trying to take Assad out of Syria for a long time with the assumption that Assad was Iran's number one ally, which has actually been a mistake for a long time because Assad and Syria haven't been Iran's number one ally for a while. Al-Maliki in Iraq have been. So this offers an opportunity to take out Assad and al-Maliki, as well as moving into Hezbollah territory, which is Iran's number one sort of proxy power in the region. So America, I think, can sit by quietly while ISIS does its work, because ISIS is coincidentally doing America's work. So I think that the reason for the silence was that it worked for American foreign policy. And if it seems bizarre to be working with, you know, your enemy, then you just have to look back at American history to see how consistently we have worked with our enemies from World War II on, where America often sided with fascists and Nazi collaborators in the fight against communists all through Europe and the Far East, through Afghanistan in the 80s, you know, arming the Islamist groups like the Mujahideen against Russia. And then even currently, you see the continued allying with Nazi-type organizations in the Ukraine. And you also see the backing radical Islamist groups in Syria. Coincidentally, ISIS, the same group we're fighting now. So you get them working with their enemy to get rid of the current enemy of the day. And then you think, but the problem is you get left with ISIS in power, and surely America doesn't want that. But the thing about that is twofold. One is, all you have to do is look at the Salafist government in Saudi Arabia to see that America really doesn't have a problem working with their enemies, as long as it works really well for them. And the other thing is, if ISIS takes out the governments that back Iran, because this is really almost everything lately is about Iran, if ISIS takes them out and you get stuck with ISIS, and in the end you don't want ISIS, then you just remove ISIS. And there's a long history in American foreign policy of using the worst dictators to accomplish your purposes in a region, because the nice thing about a really horrific dictator is that when you're ready to take them out, you can always use the fact that he's a horrific dictator to justify your taking him out. That was done with Saddam and Noriega, and the whole history of taking brutal people out that you put in with the justification they're brutal.
Yep.
So that answered the first question. The first question was answered by they were silent while ISIS advanced, because the ISIS advance worked for them. Do you want me to go on, or do you want to cut me off first?
Yeah, no, go ahead, because we can do all the follow-ups in the next segment. So go ahead and on the second point.
So then the big question is, if the reason you let ISIS advance was because it served your foreign policy, it served your interests, then why suddenly stop ISIS from advancing? Why go against the motivation of the first one? And I think the thing is that they're actually not inconsistent at all, because though America benefits from ISIS's success in the Levant, it would be better to get rid of al-Maliki and Assad without ISIS. Although, you know, it's good to have ISIS do what you couldn't do. If you can do it without them, that would be great too. And the nice thing about the ISIS advance is that before it was completely successful in Iraq, it offered America enormous leverage in Iraq, because here's Iraq with one quarter of it already being taken over by ISIS. So America can leverage that by telling Baghdad that we're only going to come and rescue you from ISIS if you get rid of al-Maliki, which is the purpose, right? The regime change and the governments that are their allies of Iran. If you get rid of al-Maliki, we'll come and help you. And so what happens when you look at this is not a single event, but an event in the sort of causal historical chain, is right before the bombing, you get Obama saying that he's willing to commit to strikes in Iraq. But if you look at his wording carefully, what he's really saying is that we're willing to do strikes in Iraq if you put in the government that we want put in. So for example, Obama says that Iraq is going to have to show us that they're willing and ready to try to maintain a unified Iraqi government that's based on compromise. He says that we're not going to let ISIS establish a caliphate in Syria and Iraq, but we can only do that if we've got partners that are on the ground who are capable of filling the void. In other words, we don't have partners in Iraq capable of filling the void, so we're not doing it, but we will do it if we get the government that we want. So first he says, we'll go in and help if we get the government we want. Then he goes in to help, and within days of that, you get Iraq's new president moving to take out Maliki by not not nominating him to run again. So you get this sequence of three events. The first event is, we'll help you if you get rid of Maliki. Then America starts helping, and then immediately they get rid of Maliki. So either way, whether ISIS goes in or doesn't, America can use this to accomplish regime change in Iraq. And I think that's not a coincidence. That's a pattern.
All right, now hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with the follow-up questions and more with Ted Snyder. This article will be running tomorrow on antiwar.com, the American response to ISIS. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got Ted Snyder on the line. He's been writing articles lately for antiwar.com. This one will be running tomorrow. And boy, I think you sure are right about what you say here, Ted. And I wanted to point out this interview of Barack Obama by Jeffrey Goldberg from March of 2012. Not quite even a year into the Arab Spring revolt and then hijacked jihad in Syria going on there. And Jeffrey Goldberg says, can we talk about it as a strategic issue? And what else can be done? And Obama just goes straight for it. There's no doubt Iran is much weaker, but if we can get a transition in the government in Syria here and get rid of Bashar al-Assad, that would be, quote, a profound loss for Iran. And they both throw in an obligatory thing about the poor little people they care so much about, but they make it very clear. And Obama even jokes along the lines of, he says, I could tell you, but your classified clearance isn't good enough. Laughter. So one of those, or I'd have to kill you kind of jokes, only he botched it. So there you go. He admits exactly what it's about is bringing Iran down a peg. And I'll go ahead and mention this. I won't play it because it takes too long, but I'll mention this clip. You can Google it real easy, everybody. It's Oren, O-R-E-N, Sunnis versus Shiites. In fact, Google, it's Jeffrey Goldberg again. Google Oren, Goldberg, and Sunnis. It'll come right up on YouTube. And he said the same thing to the Jerusalem Post last October. And that is that he, speaking for the Israeli government, says, listen, we prefer Al-Qaeda suicide bomber, prisoner beheader lunatics to Hezbollah and Assad because they're backed by Iran and we don't like Iran. And so I know that there are Americans who have their policy about they don't like Iran either. But then again, the official policy of the president and his government is now to at least make nice on the biggest outstanding issue with them and resolve the nuclear deal, which they are at least legitimately trying to do and probably will succeed in doing. And here's a country that's declared independence from America, but is actually not an enemy of America. And when you talk about regime change in Iraq, Ted, you're talking about getting rid of Nouri al-Maliki, the Dawa Party guy, and replacing him with the new guy, Abadi, the Dawa Party guy, along with the consent of the president of Iran, who has insisted that Maliki step aside and let this go on. And that's no aberration. That's been the exact same story since the start of this war in 2003, is that America's been fighting for Iran in Iraq, whether they like Maliki or not is kind of beside the point, obviously. It's the United Iraqi Alliance government that they're fighting for, the Shiite government, and mostly filled with sock puppets of the Iranians, this whole time. And
if you remember, too, Scott, both Iran and the States made it clear a number of weeks ago that they would be willing to work together in a non-military way in Iraq with regard to ISIS. So if non-military leaves political, then Iran's cooperation or at least endorsement of the American choice could suggest that they are working politically behind the scenes together in Iraq. So you've got to get rid of al-Maliki, but if a government's going to succeed in Iraq, it's got to be Shia and it's got to have the approval of Iran. So that suggests that kind of working in this behind the scenes as well.
Yeah. Well, and then you just go and look at Julian Borger and Robert Dreyfus and James Bamford and their work about Israel's role, and of course the neoconservatives' role on behalf of Israel, align us into war with Iraq in the first place, which turned out just to benefit Iran so much that that became the excuse that, oops, well, I guess now we got to redirect, as Seymour Hersh called it, the redirection. Now we got to back Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon and back Mujahideen, Muslim Brotherhood, and worse in Syria. And that was right around the time of the awakening, too, in Iraq, to redirect toward the Sunnis, even the worst of the Sunni al-Qaeda types, in order to contain the results of what they'd done for Israel and that benefited Iran the most in the first place. And now they still just continue on the same path, as you said, turning at the very least a blind eye and really, of course, helping the Qataris and the Saudis and everybody back the Mujahideen war in Syria all along. At the same time that they've been helping the Iraqi government, not as much as they could have, I guess, in order to contain these guys, keep them out of Baghdad, and now full-scale bombing runs in order to keep them out of Kurdistan.
And so it's interesting, too, if you look at this pattern that I was suggesting that this has to do with Iran, as you're saying, and you look at the countries that ISIS went through without America putting up a roadblock, which is Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. But then you look at what happened when there was concern that ISIS might move into Jordan, which is not an ally of Iran, but instead an ally of Israel and the United States. And as soon as there was any mention of ISIS going into Jordan, then the Daily Beast ran an article quoting Israeli officials saying that if ISIS went into Jordan, then the Israelis and probably the Americans would intervene. So you get this pattern that as long as the countries ISIS is moving through our Iranian allies, America lets it happen. But the moment ISIS goes outside of that Iranian sphere, then America doesn't let it happen. So it's not only the countries that are being invaded that show that the pattern is about Iran, it's also the countries that are not being invaded yet that show that it's really about Iran.
Yeah. Well, and you know, think about it, that the Israelis have even more interest, depending, I guess, on the level of Benjamin Netanyahu's ambition here to go ahead and provoke this even worse, let ISIS get even more powerful in order to justify intervening in Jordan. You talk about tigers to the Euphrates, let's get it on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens? Mitchell Prothero says, boy, Israel moves into Jordan on the other side of the river, then you're turning over the whole damn table at that point, and the entire Middle East goes up in flames in ways that nobody can predict.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
And, you know, this can also, and, you know, this is speculative, but this can also have to do with the nuclear deal being worked out with Iran, because one of the things that's also striking that I haven't written about yet and I haven't seen much on is that not only was America silent as Iran's allies got overrun, but Iran's been pretty silent too. And that's also interesting, like, why has Iran let their three allies get overrun like this? And, you know, speculatively, one of the possibilities is that this is about the nuclear deal, that if the nuclear deal succeeds, which it looks like it might, then the two things America's wanted to do with Iran is not only dearm them, but also isolate them. And this would be a way that if you did get Iran with civilian nuclear power, you would be enhancing the isolation of them by taking Iraq and Syria and Lebanon away. So you'd sort of be giving on the one hand, but taking on the other hand away. And the other thing is that if Iran did get involved, then the State Department could use this as a justification that Iran is interventionist and getting involved in the region, and therefore we can't negotiate with them because this is, you know, what we've always said about, you know, the mad mullahs of Iran. Mm-hmm. So I think there's also the possibility that this is linked to the how to come out okay of the Iran nuclear negotiations as well. And that's purely speculative, but it's a thought.
Yep, very good point. All right, well, listen, I really appreciate your time and appreciate your articles that you write for antiwar.com. I'm pretty sure I've approved all of them. It's great stuff there, Ted.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I was listening on your show. Thank you.
All right, that's Ted Snyder, everybody. He writes about American foreign policy and history, and you can find his articles often at antiwar.com. This one is called The American Response to ISIS. In fact, it goes on. Let me see here. There are patterns, not coincidences. Yeah, that's right. In fact, I'm going to play that Michael Oren clip for y'all later, too. Be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Sandy Tolan coming up on the Gaza war. Well, no, on the history of Israel's relationship with Gaza preceding the war, really. All right. Now, I guess I'm being a little redundant here. I've played this interview or this clip before for you on the show, but it is important. It's quite relevant to the conversation we were just having here. This is Michael Oren, who is, as of last October, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, although I believe he's an American before he's an Israeli, but he's an Israeli first now. Chronological is one thing, priorities is another. And yes, he does in fact say in this interview over and over again. Now, this is just my opinion, okay? I'm not speaking for the Israeli government here. And he also says over and over again, so the Israeli government's point of view is this, because that's the truth, and he can't help but slip and keep saying it over and over again. He is absolutely defining the Israeli government's policy. When he said this last October, there was no secret that he was speaking for the government that he represented. The title in the Jerusalem Post was Israel, meaning the government, has wanted to get rid of Assad from the beginning. And here he is explaining why to Jeffrey Goldberg at the Aspen Ideas Festival.
No, you're not.
And what I'm going to say is harsh, perhaps a little edgy. But if we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. For the reason
you're not speaking for me.
Okay, when he's saying the Sunnis over the Shiites, he's being deliberately vague. But in context, there's no question who he's talking about. He's talking about the Mujahideen war in Syria and Iraq. Okay? He's not saying, theoretically, oh, we like Saudi Arabia's kingdom more than Iran. That's not what's in question here, okay? They're talking about the Mujahideen war. I should rewind it to the whole question and everything so it's in context for you here.
Ding. If Maliki doesn't stay in there for another couple more weeks, what do you think your country's doing in order to protect your interests, and how are you working to align with other partners?
All right, keep in mind, I don't speak for the government anymore. I'm speaking for me and Jeff.
No, you're not.
And what I'm going to say is harsh, perhaps a little edgy. But if we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. For the reason
you're
I
not speaking
before.
For me.
Okay, it's a lesser evil. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail. And I'm speaking entirely for myself. As the Sykes-Picot system breaks down, Israel has got to guard its borders. We have built a high-tech fence very quickly along our Egyptian border. We're building a high-tech fence along our Syrian border. We have a primary interest in maintaining the stability of Jordan. Our security border is not the Jordanian-Israeli border, it's the Jordanian-Iraqi border. Jordan, among other things, is what keeps that mess out of our backyards. And we'll be working to shore up Jordan. And I know when I was in Washington and working on the Hill, I was always working to shore up Jordan. Very important for us. We're going to have to hunker down for a while. One of the most amazing things, I understand we're coming to an end.
All right. Well, should I let it go on? It's just another minute and a half. I forget if he says anything more important or not.
And, well, I was couple people saw me in Chicago, Lee, this week. When I was in Chicago briefing you on the depressing situation in the Middle East. My wife was getting into a helicopter and helicoptering down to Masada to see a high-tech Cirque du Soleil-type production of La Traviata. Right? 7,000 people.
Please, hurry.
Great images projected up on Masada. And this is all going on in Israel. There's this fabulous food in Tel Aviv. People are on the beaches. And every once in a while, you got to stop and think that if Sally got into a car at Masada and drove 4 hours northward, she'd be in downtown Damascus. If you got in a car and drove 6 hours southward, you'd be in Tahrir Square. If you drove an hour eastward, you'd be in...
No, that's enough. I cannot wait for this piece of crap to get to his crappy point. I just don't have the stomach for it. I just don't have the heart. Let's stick to the actual what's important here. I mean, right there, he's saying, yes, we're, it's a European settler colony in the heart of another civilization. So, yes, surrounded by people who don't like you, even though their governments are all paid by the Americans to pretend to like you. Got it. Yeah, we know. Anyway, the point is, here's the point. It's high treason. High treason. For the American politicians, including President Barack Obama, who I was just quoting for you from The Atlantic from 2012, admitting his guilt, to go along with this Michael Oren, Israel First, foreign policy that has America backing the, I mean, Nusra is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's what Nusra is. ISIS is just a break off from al-Nusra. It's Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's what it is. It's the same thing. The only thing that they're fighting about is who's got to take orders from who. Not about anything else. The way our government has said it for the last 15 years or so is that Al-Qaeda is like the Soviet Union and is this gigantic superpower somewhere. And any and everything they don't like is somehow linked to it and that kind of thing. Well, look. This guy, Baghdadi, is now the head of a state that really exists and has pretty much defined borders for now, although they're at war over exactly where they're going to end up, and is run by bin Laden incarnate. This guy, Baghdadi, is probably worse than if bin Laden was in charge, actually, as far as all the just completely ridiculous, indiscriminate massacres of Shiites just for being Shiites and this kind of thing. And so these are the bin Ladenites. And so for America to have a policy in Syria that benefits them is treason. If America was outright, like in the days of George W. Bush, outright backing Assad and paying him to torture and murder Mujahideen for us, that would not be treason. I would not support that. I did not support that all during it. But that would not be treason. That would just be horrible. But backing the Mujahideen against him is treason. And you can go read it in the Post and read it in the Times. And I know all the politics are saying, well, Hillary says we should have intervened in Syria. And Obama says hogwash. That wouldn't have worked very well. Yeah, they did intervene in Syria. They were backing the Mujahideen. Even the New York Times, and yes, confirmation bias. If they said the opposite, I'd be accusing them. But here they're saying that I'm right, and so they're right. And it happens to be true, so that's good, too. There are more and better sources that you could find. But the official newspaper of record, and as well their counterpart, the Washington Post, have both admitted over years, it's been 3 years now, guys, over years, that the CIA has been helping to coordinate Saudi and Qatar with the money for the guns and the money for the money, and Jordan and Turkey with the travel and getting the Mujahideen and the Saudis too for that, getting the Mujahideen there to fight and training up what they claim are the moderates, but who really are just the procurement front organizations for the jihadists. The title in the New York Times is Most U.S. Arms. Or I forget if it's U.S. exactly, but most arms ending up with the jihadists. Because guess what? Moderates don't do a lot of fighting. The guys who like dying do the most and get the most and best guns and money and have for the last 3 years. And that makes Obama actually worse than George Bush, really. Outright on their side. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm going to try and see if I can get Jason on to talk about Ukraine in the next segment. And then later we're going to have Sandy Tolan on. He wrote this great thing about the history of Israel's relationship with the Hamas and Gaza since 2005, the election there. It sounds, yeah, boring, but no, it's really good. It's really important. It's a major lie PR talking point of the Israelis about how everything is their victim's fault, and he's completely debunked it here and more, and you know, but that's the part I want to focus on at least at first. Good stuff. It's at tomdispatch.com. And well, hell, I guess I ain't gonna get to talk to James Bamford today. The plan was to talk to James Bamford today. James wrote a brand new thing for Wired all about Ed Snowden. It's really good. Breaks a couple new stories in there too, including that when Syria's internet was turned off and they blamed it on Assad, it was the NSA that did it. They put some code into a router and it bricked the damn router and shut down the whole damn internet. And they were terrified that they were going to get busted, and that the Syrian government would find their malware, whatever you call it exactly, their worm, whatever they did to the thing, the code, and bust their ass. But the Syrian government was more interested in getting the internet back up than figuring out what the hell had happened, and they had just replaced the router and moved on with life or something, I guess. Anyway, tells that story there. And then another one was about a program that automatically searches for internet attacks and searches out their origins and then attacks them back. But it's all automated. It's called Monster Mind. It's all automated, and he said, well, of course, they hit the wrong targets all the time, because if you're some evil, you know, hacker guy, what you do is you use some hospital's computer network to be the front, but of course, it's all just ones and zeros. It's a trick, and so this automated program ends up attacking completely innocent parties who themselves were, you know, first hijacked by the attackers and then become the victims of the counterattack. And how he thought that was really problematic and really irresponsible that they would do that, because they don't know what they're shutting down. It could be a hospital. Could be a matter of life and death, but they don't care because they suck. Anyway, and he just tells a story about his time at the CIA and the NSA a little more and whatever. It was interesting. And, you know, I wish that he had had Bamford go with Greenwald to Hong Kong. Although I guess, well, I don't know. Would the NSA have caught that? Hey, Bamford and Greenwald are getting on a plane to Hong Kong together. They didn't apparently notice Greenwald and Poitras. I wonder what Greenwald and Poitras are doing in Hong Kong. Nice total information awareness, you idiots. Your stupid conspiracy theory machine can't come up with crap even when a plot is on. Anyway, Bamford. Well, maybe we'll talk to Bamford tomorrow or the next day. I guess we'll see. James Bamford in Wired with the new one there. And then, I can skip Ukraine because I'm going to save that for hopefully Jason in just a minute. Just a few minutes. So here, well, what the hell? I got a bunch of news here that I need to catch up on. Well, let me just, I don't want to waste this whole segment lecturing about Ferguson. But I do want to point out that they set a no-fly zone over the country, which immediately reminded me of the situation in Los Angeles when they told the media, get your helicopters back, as then they were busted live on video. Max Blumenthal recorded it, saying, activate the burners, throw in the incendiary devices to set fire to the cabin that former LAPD whistleblower turned victim again. was burned to death there. And they said, hey, media, get back, because we're going to burn this guy to death. And we would actually prefer if you just got, if you guys had more of kind of a far away shot rather than a close up of it. Thanks. And of course, all the media complied. They just complied. They didn't say, you don't have the authority to tell us that. Or go ahead and shoot us down then. We're going to be witness to your murder of this guy. Or anything like that. Well, same thing here. No fly zone over Ferguson. Why is that? What does it matter if Delta Airlines flies overhead? What does it matter if TV news helicopters fly overhead? Other than they might catch the police criminals in the act of committing more crimes against the people of Ferguson. That's their guilty conscience predicting further horrors. Hey guys, we can't stay in Iraq without an immunity deal for, you know, when we commit war crimes, we're going to need immunity for that. Hey, you know what? Before we just start, you know, sniping whatever black people we don't like in the town of Ferguson, killing them in front of their mothers and everything, we ought to make the helicopters get back there. I hope people are turning on cell phone cameras and just kind of stashing them places, you know, in trees, in windows and stuff, and leaving them running. Because after they kill you, they can take your cell phone camera away and destroy it, you know? You need them up everywhere, little private ones everywhere. And then you can, you know, record, you know, have your survivors post a YouTube of what happens to you. Anyway. Yeah, it's a hell of a thing. And here's the thing. And I know this sounds crazy in 2014 America, but I don't think it's crazy at all. I don't think it's crazy at all. I don't think it's even the libertarian thing to do, okay? I think that a Democrat or Republican politician who simply means well could do what I'm about to suggest. And that is that the governor of Missouri could... And I don't know exactly what it would take. He'd have to work with the attorney general of the state and maybe with the legislature or whatever. But if he asked for it, they would go along with it. And if they had to pass a legislation to get it done, then that would happen. The state legislature is absolutely supreme in this situation. And they should call the entire city police department and or the sheriff's department. I'm not exactly clear on the situation with the relationship there and who all has what hard feelings. Maybe get rid of the sheriff's department and the city police, and then you send in the state troopers. I'm not talking about a libertarian anarchist solution here, guys. I'm talking about what could happen in real life right now with the current governor, okay? He could call out the state police, tell all the local police, all of you, go on vacation. You're done for now. Beat it. State police, you go out there, no armor, no machine guns, no armored personnel carriers. You go out there and you tell the people protesting in the streets and whatever, I'm here to protect your rights. I have nothing to do with what happened before, and you may be mad as hell. You can even yell at me if you want, but blam, and de-escalate the entire thing, Matlock's or Andy Griffith style. And not even Andy Griffith. That's utopian and beautiful. No. How about just a decent, concerned set of politicians with power who've got to end this crisis? It is not the case that the angry and feral blacks of St. Louis are arming themselves for war against the police. That's not happening here. They don't need their machine guns. They don't need their snipers. They don't need their armored personnel carriers. This is a police, a peaceful protest of outrage against their aggressive murder of one person, not a battle that took place. There's no further skirmish to come. The entire thing could be de-escalated right now by saying we want state police in blouses and slacks out there being polite and de-escalating. Right now, they could do that, and they're not doing that. Right now, it's all just more cops, more cops, more cops. More armor, more camouflage, more machine guns. And then what do you think a cop, one of these meathead idiots, you know, veins pulsing full of steroids. See, I was going to cover a lot more news and not just rant for the whole segment. But anyway, what do you think is going through the mind of these meatheads when they're dressed up like soldiers that they're not? patrolling around in a town like this, wearing all camouflage with their little floppy sniper hat and even their camouflage sniper rifle and all of their armor. They're looking for some Iraqis to kill, and you're the Iraqis. It's a hell of a costume, man. And that's their mindset. And you see how they are. They'll take the first opportunity that you could possibly give them to kill you. Right? You could hear them in your imagination saying to each other, first and any chance I get to kill anyone, I'll take it. Because I'm a police, and that's my job, is to kill people anytime I can. And anytime I can means, except on Saturday night, you know, off duty, you can't kill your best friend for sleeping with your wife, you know, because you're drunk and yada-da. That won't work. You got to be clocked in. But once you're clocked in, you can kill anyone. And especially if they're black and unarmed. I've recommended before all black men should start carrying guns, all of them, so they can at least defend themselves if they are attacked. But I think maybe it's the unarmed nature of the black men that makes them the target so much.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Man, CNN is really showing some good pictures of the militarization here of these cops and just how far out of control they are. You know, I want to go back over something that Will Grigg was, we were talking about with Will Grigg the other day. It was that town in Michigan. This is a small town in Michigan. This is a cool story. Listen up, god dang it. Small town in Michigan. And what happened was the cops there got out of control. The chief died. They got a new chief. And he came in there with a brain full of steroids and decided to get a bunch of armored personnel carriers and advanced weapons from the Pentagon. Give up your empire or live under it. And he hired a bunch of extra cops that they didn't need. And then he said, now go and get them. And he unleashed these stormtroopers of death on this town. But what happened was, the way the town is set up, and I guess the history of the community there and how small it is, and the fact that the cops, one of the people that they horribly persecuted was a local businessman in town who was, you know, considered one of the town fathers or whatever that people really had a lot of respect for. And they were saying, now, no, wait a minute. We know that Joe is not a criminal, okay? So what the hell is this? What do you mean that he got treated this way? And so a lot of things just came together to where they were able to use their democratic power in their town and call a meeting and call the council to order and say, we want this chief fired, and we want this whole new police system he brought rolled back now. And they did it. He resigned. Now, I don't know how much they've rolled back and who all got fired. And I don't, you know, what are they giving the armored personnel carriers back to the Pentagon? I sure would like to see it. I don't know just how far. There's that ratchet effect, right? Never quite get it all the way back to the way it was before. Even when you can cancel them out. But, you know, and I'm not a big fan of democracy, you know, certainly as an end in itself or anything like that. The goal is liberty. But that goes to show, as Ron Paul has always said, that, you know what, even in the communist countries, with some exceptions at some times, but ultimately, even in the communist countries, what the people want ends up the way it is. When the people are just refuse to accept the legitimacy and the operation of the Soviet Union any longer, it's gone. It didn't even fall. It evaporated. It went home. It was just over. That kind of thing. Yeah, well, I do that sometimes. But anyway, yeah, so militarization. I lost my train of thought, but I'm not too far off it. something about the Soviet Union or something. I don't know how the hell I got there. Anyway, Ferguson, it's de facto martial law over there. Oh, I know what it was. We were talking about the story about in Michigan. I don't know what that had to do with Russia. But the town in Michigan, the people use their power. Oh, I know what it was. Yeah, Ron Paul always says the people get what they demand ultimately. And so exactly what your system is, it does depend. Democracies are easier to get your way in than fascist dictatorships. Although, you know, just like the 10th Amendment Center guys, they fight and fight and fight. It's not easy, but there are battles to be fought and won in democratic politics. Even Lysander Spooner said it is no sin to vote in self-defense. If this other guy's going to get you killed or close, then, man, it's perfectly fair to go and try to vote for the other guy. You know? All's fair in all that kind of love and war. That's what Rothbard said. Rothbard was, you know, Mr. Anarcho-Capitalist, and he engaged in all kinds of politics all the time. And speaking of which, I wanted to find a segue, and here it is. Dan Sanchez wrote this thing. Oh, man. It didn't come up on the first page here. Let me see. Oh, it's at Medium. Okay, Dan Sanchez at Medium. He's got this great quote of Murray Rothbard from 1967. And where'd it go, man? It's not at the top of his page. I don't know why. What am I looking at here? Here's Rothbard's Red Pill, but that's old. Where's the latest? Well, crap. I don't know. If you look at my Twitter feed, maybe I can find it in my Twitter feed here. I tweeted out last night. Dan Sanchez, he had this great Rothbard quote from 1967. Oh, yeah, there it was. Wait. Dan. Here we go. Palestinians, not the only population under occupation since 1967. The other population occupied since 67. Here's the Rothbard quote. It's at dansanchez.me. I can't keep track of all this guy's URLs. He's at Mises Institute. Yeah. Good old Dan Sanchez. The Palestinians aren't the only people who have been militarily occupied since 1967. And it's a quote from Murray Rothbard. And yes, he uses the term Negro in here, and it's quite politically correct now, even though I think that is the anthropologically correct term. But anyway, no one would say that now. But the point is, it's 1967 when he's saying this, and he's certainly taking their side. He's not trying to be some bigot, okay? So please bear with the ancient language here. It is no accident, Murray Rothbard writes. It is no accident that virtually every single case of black rebellion in the cities in the summer of 1967 was precipitated by police brutality, by beating up a Negro cab driver in Newark, by raiding and beating up an after-hours drinking club in Detroit. It is also no accident that despite all the press hysteria about sniping and looting, the greatest bulk of the crimes committed during the riots was by the enforcement, thugs of the state, the police, the National Guard, the federal troops. Almost all the killings were of Negroes by the police and troops. In fact, the behavior of these enforcers was clearly reminiscent of the behavior of U.S. Imperial troops in Vietnam, or, in fact, of military occupiers anywhere in their continuing permanent war against the native colored population. Thus, if a sniper fired from a building, the characteristic response of our police, guard, army, protectors was to spray fire into the entire building, heedless of the destruction and the casualties that would have to follow. One of the great lessons of the summer rebellions, which we all should absorb, is that the black population of the United States is a colonized and subject people. That's Mr. Rothbard. And that could have been said by any black radical, but that is the most libertarian, individualist, capitalist, natural rights, anarchist in the whole world right there. That's the guy that wrote Man, Economy, and State. And that's just the plain, simple truth. Well, look what's going on. And, you know, you hear about the unemployment rate overall, and of course they always fudge the numbers and make everything sound fine, but there are a lot of places in this country right now who, mostly because all their wealth was squandered murdering Arabs for nothing, are living in terrible situations right now. Some communities have unemployment rates in the 20%, 30%. And of course, you know, minority communities end up always being hit the hardest in the boom and the bust, which again is not a business cycle, but is in fact a government manipulation of bank credit cycle. Where people finally, oh man, we're finally doing all right. Moving on up to the east side. Blam! And then the Federal Reserve bubble pops and the whole thing comes crashing down. It's a war against us all, and those with the least political power suffer the worst first. That's how it works. And I like this Dan's hashtag Ferguson, and it stops today. That was the quote of Eric Garner, the man who was strangled to death by the NYPD over a false accusation that he was selling individual cigarettes without a license. Really? That was his crime. And the one cop wrapped his arm around his throat, and that was it. You could hear the cop thinking, whoopee, I'm murdering this guy, and I'm going to get away with it too. Yay, murder. Die. You N-word, the cop was thinking. You could see the word bubble right above his head in the video as he chokes him to death. As the guy's last words are, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, over and over again. That's America, 2014. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And yeah, you know what? God dang, I got to talk about gun control again. This is so important. Because I guess I like to think I have the opportunity to talk to liberals who might be interested in my anti-war position about things that maybe they're not used to being on the same side of as whatever. But the entire American police state, which is so far out of control now, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And you look at any of the studies of the growth of the national police forces, and for that matter, the state and local police forces, just since September 11th, 2001. Never even mind already how horrible it's been since Nixon and since before, but since J. Edgar Hoover in the 30s. The police state is just so freaking far out of control. And then, of course, it's those who are racial minorities and are monetary minorities, the poor, who end up on, first of all, are the ones that liberals proclaim to love the most, but also are the ones who end up on the receiving end, the hard end of all their social engineering projects. You know, this all the community policing and broken windows policing. What does broken windows policing mean? It means completely go after anyone for anything, you know, in order to protect the greater atmosphere of the place. So it's not about, oh, subsidizing people to fix their broken windows. It's prosecuting jaywalking to the hilt. You know, looking for any excuse to screw with anybody, not to solve crimes, but to make everything better the way some professor imagines will work right. Well, he and all the other professors in the teachers' lounge and the police union agree that, yeah, they ought to go ahead and try to completely reorder everything their way. You know, it'd be really nice. It's such a shame that so many poor minority people die of gunshot wounds all the time. Maybe we could stop that by outlawing guns more and more and coming up with more ways to charge people for gun possession crimes. And then that way we'll get these guns off the street and help make especially the east or west or north or whichever side it is in your town a bit safer place. And of course, all it means is arresting people for nothing. It's just like the war on drugs. And it's funny because sometimes liberals, they get so caught up in their social engineering, they actually start complaining about the disparity in drug war prosecutions as though what really isn't fair is that white people are getting away with it. No, that's not the problem. Other than the fact that it's white people who, maybe not the very same ones though, right? But yeah, it's white people by and large who would support the war on drugs, maybe. I don't know even if that's true. Anyway, what's unfair is that poorer minorities end up locked up for crimes that white people, by and large, don't get locked up for as often or for as long. It's the same thing with guns. It's the same thing with everything. It's the same thing with dealing with the local health inspector at, you know, their restaurant or whatever it is. Anything. You know, all this, use the stormtroopers of death, these people that you rightly hate and fear for their impunity and their just unmitigated brutality when it comes to dealing with Americans of all stripes on all sides of town now. Brutalizing people all the time, killing them in their homes in the middle of the night on drug raids on a regular basis where it's hardly even newsworthy anymore. It's, you know, this is what the Navy SEALs and the Delta Force do, hunting down the Taliban in Afghanistan, kicking their doors in the middle of the night, you know, amid their families and kill them and oftentimes their families and their neighbors and whoever. You know, this is, it's completely out of control. And for people to really, and this is why all liberals ought to be libertarians. They just give it up, okay? As Anthony Gregory would instruct you, the state is the conservative means to your liberal ends, and that's just not cutting it, okay? It's freedom is what your and every other people need so that they can do better. So, you know, no matter what color you are, what religion you are, whatever, anywhere on the left you are, you ought to be an anarcho, whatever you are. And not a statist anymore. And not ask, not be the demand for the government supply of their brutality anymore. You know, the guy that got killed at Walmart, we talked about this last week. Oh my God, a black guy with a gun at the Walmart. It was a pellet gun that he got at Walmart. It was on the rack, on the shelf. He got it and was going to buy it. I'm not making this up. This really happened in Ohio. He's like a 21-year-old guy, 21-year-old kid to me. I'm so old now. He picks up a freaking BB gun. A lady called the cops on him. Oh no, I'm uncomfortable for a moment because of my retarded misunderstanding. Where emotions? What should I do? So she called the Gestapo, communist Nazi stormtroopers of death, to come and kill this guy. Freeze! Bang, 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 and they killed him in the Walmart for shopping for a pellet gun. These are the people that you want to guarantee a minimum wage that is the one that you would like for it to be for whatever ignorant, non-economic reasons that you believe. These are the people who you want to make sure that you don't have to compete with Mexicans at your job because it's not fair that you have to compete with Mexicans at your job. These are the people who you want to keep Chinese goods out. These are the people you want to bring democracy to the Middle East. These are the people you want to solve poverty by waging a war on it. A war. These are the people you expect to protect your property at all. We talked with Will Green yesterday about how these cops, after they killed this innocent guy, instead of going, whoa, man, okay, listen, everybody, be cool, they just ratchet up and ratchet up and ratchet up until finally there's a small riot that leads to the breaking of a few store windows and the burning of a Quickie Mart, which, oh my God, it's like the LA riots times 10, if, you know, you want to believe that, but of course it wasn't. But it was enough that it was a problem. And so then what'd the cops do? Line up on the sidewalk in front of all the storefronts to protect the stores, to protect the private property owners, to protect the taxpayers, as the cops call them? Hell no. They were nowhere to be seen. They were out causing a riot, not solving one. It was the, and go read about it. It was local people who came out and stood with guns in front of their stores and did not kill anyone. Did not go all rogue vigilante. They hate the cops too. But they were just worried that maybe, you know, the gun store would get looted. And, you know, and whatever other businesses, they didn't want their stores looted. So they stood out front and they told the looters, you guys probably should move on. And that was it. In fact, I think the word got out that those store owners have guns out front, so let's not mess with them. Let's go this way. And help solve the problem. You know, turns out we don't need these people at all. And somebody find me the stats. I bet Balco has them. Someone find me the stats of who gets prosecuted for gun possession charges. Not for using one on someone, but for having one when the government says that they can't. Show me the racial numbers there, the disparity there, liberals. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, you guys. Welcome back to the show. As promised, one more guest, Sandy Tolan at TomDispatch.com, the great Tom Engelhart. And it'll be running. I'm looking at it right now. You guys will be able to see it tomorrow at Antiwar.com as well. Sandy is a Tom Dispatch regular. He's the author of The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East, and the forthcoming Children of the Stone, about the building of a music school under occupation in the West Bank. Man, isn't that interesting? He's an associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. I'm sorry, I must say boo-hiss to that because I'm the son of a Bruin. And so, loyalties come first. You know how it is. But thank you very much for joining us again on the show, Sandy. How are you? Oh, I hit the wrong dang button. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. I'm sorry. I hit the telephone button instead of the Skype one because I wasn't paying attention because I was distracted by the fact that you teach at USC, which I'm supposed to regard as a major problem or something because it's in my upbringing.
You know, we got different colors, man. What can I say?
Yeah, well, I lived in LA for a couple of years, I guess. I don't know. But I found USC to be a very enchanting place, to be perfectly honest. Okay. Hey, welcome back to the show, Sandy. It's good to talk to you. And what a great article you've written here. It's called Going Wild in the Gaza War. Tom's got a great little introduction there and then his blown chances in Gaza, which is a very nice way of putting it here. But it's a very good history of more or less since the democratic elections in Palestine in 2005. And the surprising victory of Hamas and the history of how we got to the current crisis since then. And I'm really happy that you wrote this thing. It's really good. And I was hoping that you could really help fill us in on, you know, especially that early period there, the first couple of years, because as I'm sure you're aware, there's a very popular Israeli talking point, which is that, well, we completely granted independence to Gaza back in 2005, and instead of making paradise, they decided to shoot their bottle rockets at us and force us to put them under siege. And, hey, maybe that's somewhat true. I don't know, but I sure would like to really have some details about what really went down with the American and Israeli engineered, in fact, election of 05, its results, and the aftermath. So please do tell, sir.
Well, thanks. First of all, Scott, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a complicated history, as is so much in the Middle East. I think it's in this case. I mean, you can go back for years or even centuries, but even to the late 19th century if you want to. But let's start in 2004, 2005, around the time that Ariel Sharon, 2005, when Ariel Sharon had decided to so-called disengage from Gaza. 8,000 settlers were removed, the settlements were removed, and basically the Israelis said, okay, now Palestinians in Gaza, it's up to you to make your paradise, as you said. I don't think they used those exact words, but you now have a free society. Well, in fact, the occupation never ended. Israel has always been in control. There's a brilliant book by a guy named A.L. Weitzman called The Hollow Land. which it is an architect's account of the architecture of the occupation, an Israeli architect, for that matter. And it's a very critical account. And in it, among other many things, he explains, as have others, that the occupation never really ended. It's controlled. Israel is controlling the skies above Gaza, the seas around Gaza, and the ability for people and goods to remove to move in and out of Gaza. It's no secret, and there's good reason why Gazans say that they're trapped in the largest open air prison in the world. So that's the context. They never really were allowed to for freedom. The so-called corridor that was going to connect the West Bank and Gaza under the Oslo peace process never materialized, still hasn't to this day. And Gazans felt increasingly frustrated leading up to the 2006 election with the corruption of the very pro-Western Fatah organization. And Hamas was not elected because people wanted a terrorist movement in control. They were not elected because suddenly people didn't care about having a just peace with freedom. They were elected because of the corruption of Hamas, and it's corruption of Fatah, rather, and Fatah's inability to deliver any modicum of freedom and a just peace. So Hamas was elected. Now, clearly that Hamas was responsible for terrorist acts in the past, as were some Israeli organizations going back to the 1930s and 40s, whose leaders later became prime ministers of Israel. It's Yitzhak Shamir Yitzhak Shamir and Menachem Begin. But what is clear and not as well known is that Hamas, for years, and especially right after the 2006 election, was sending serious messages of reconciliation towards the Americans. In a letter written on handwritten and given to Jerome Siegel of the Jewish Peace Lobby, and a professor based at the University of Maryland, he basically, Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas, offered to open a dialogue and pleaded almost to open a dialogue with the Bush administration. And in it, he said, "We could understand. We are so worried about stability in this region that we would like to offer. We are willing to accept a state of Palestine on the 1967 borders and offer a truce for many years." Mm-hmm. This was basically de facto recognition of Israel and an agreement to cease hostilities, which was basically two of the big things that the U.S., the U.N., Europe, and Israel were requiring.
Right.
So there's a lot of background here that Hamas has reached out actually again and again. And the answer from Israel, supported by U.S. hardware and political backing, has been war.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for being so polite. First of all, not correcting me when I said 05. It was January 06 when they had the election. So that's an important point to mention there, and sorry for the error. But then, and the letter, you know what, we may not even get back to it until after the break, but the letter and that entire theme is something that I want to go back to in just a minute. But I'd like to ask you a little more about the election itself, because I remember reading back then how they had this policy where, you know, of course, Israel collects all the tax money, and then they wouldn't give it to the Palestinian authorities. So they couldn't distribute it to pay all their employees and to pay off the people they needed to pay off in order to, frankly, buy their votes, American style, so they could win the election. And I read Emily Hauser wrote a thing for The Forward recently where she talked about it, one effort or another, I forget, that Condoleezza Rice had done to try to make it a little easier for Fatah to win the election, and how the Israelis had stopped her. And I just wondered whether you thought that maybe the Israelis deliberately rigged the election of Hamas in 2006 in order that they would have the excuse, divided and conquered, and these guys are terrorists, so we don't have to talk to them. The previous narrative had been, well, these guys aren't elected. Fatah, you know, Arafat and his guys, they're not elected, so we don't have to talk to them. Then Hamas gets elected, and they go, well, they're terrorists, so we don't have to talk to them. And I just wonder if you thought that was on purpose or not.
I rather doubt that Israel was able to rig the elections. It may have ultimately served their purposes.
I didn't mean exactly like stuffing ballots, but they set it up that way, it seemed like, maybe.
These elections were free and fair, and I think that the reason why Hamas was elected was that, you know, as I said earlier, that they really wanted to, the people, not only of Gaza, but people in the West Bank were voting too. They were tired of the corruption of Hamas. I mean, they didn't get a full 50% of the vote.
Oh, the PLA, you meant.
Of the Palestinian Authority is what I'm trying to say. Yeah,
right.
Of Fatah. So what happened was that the I think the idea that this plays into Israel's hand is that you're suggesting, I think, is a valid idea. But I think it was really a surprise election. I think everybody was stunned by the outcome.
All right, I'm sorry. You know what? We're out of time for this segment, Sandy. Can you please hold on? We'll be right back, everybody. It's Sandy Tolan. This article is at tomdispatch.com. It'll be running tomorrow at antiwar.com. We'll be right back in just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network. Full archives, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. And hey, this week is fundraising week. I'm trying not to beat you over the head about it too bad, but stop by scotthorton.org/donate if you want. All right, we're talking with Sandy Tolan. He's written this great article for tomdispatch.com. It'll be running on antiwar.com tomorrow, Blown Chances in Gaza. And I'm sorry, I got us a little off track with what was going on with that election of 06 there, Sandy. You can finish up on that if you want. I think pretty much you'd made your point about it pretty much was a surprise. They didn't know what was going to happen. And then, But you do such a great job of in your article of talking about what came after that. Including, of course, as you mentioned, this letter from the leader of Hamas to George Bush saying basically like, hey, man, here's my handout. Let's talk. And then what happens? So if you'd like to just go on with the story, you could. You can go back if you want to the election.
Right. Well, so what was established in 2006 during the Hamas election or after the Hamas election was that there was a really an outreach at that point by Hamas for some sort of reconciliation with the United States and by implication with Israel, because even though Hamas, talks a hard line and saying that they want to basically eliminate Israel, and if you look at the Hamas charter, it's disgusting. Nevertheless, as I said before, there are other organizations that have been considered terrorist organizations who said they would never compromise. And then in the back channels, there are other signals. This was a back channel offer for a serious discussion and a willingness to go much further than Hamas had ever publicly said to create essentially what was the U.S. policy, which is the two-state solution, and to offer a truce. These were the conditions, two of the large conditions that the U.S. and Israel had held over Hamas. The fact that George Bush and the Bush administration did not even reply to that letter is not really surprising, but nevertheless it's striking, and a striking piece of evidence that the U.S. and Israel were much more interested in smashing Hamas at the great human cost for the people of Gaza, as they have been really several times in these wars over the last 8 years.
And even at the time, John McCain said, well, yeah, of course you have to talk to Hamas. So that just goes to show that it wasn't, he wasn't saying, of course you have to talk to Osama bin Laden. He was saying you have to talk to Hamas, and that was reasonable.
Right. And you have, Scott, a number of people in the Israeli security establishment over the years who have said much the same thing. I mean, including a brigadier general who is the head of the Gaza division for the Israeli army. for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and the former chief of the Mossad, which is Israel's CIA. They were both saying, look, you know, one of them said, the devils of today could be people we could deal with tomorrow. The devils of yesterday could be people we could deal with today. They didn't listen to him. And then more recently, Shmuel Zakai, former brigadier general, said, look, you can't just pound the people of Gaza and Hamas and expect them to not respond at all. We need to engage them. This kind of advice has been ignored, and it was again in 2014. And this latest war was really as unnecessary or maybe even more so than all the others.
Well, now, can you take us a little bit through the cause and effect, maybe with an eye toward the debunking of this talking point, if you think it deserves debunking, about, you know, what exactly took place? Of course, there's the Gaza bombshell, the coup, and Hamas ended up taking control of the whole strip, I guess, in 2007. But, you know, if you could tell that story as fast as you can about how we got from the election of Hamas to the outright siege, because the Israeli story is they just kept shooting rockets at us, and so that's all you need to know.
Well, I mean, Israel has had Gaza in a blockade for many years. I mean, the sanctions were imposed immediately after the election in 2006 because even though it was a free and fair election, Israel and the West decided it would not contend with a terrorist organization. And you know, as Avi Schleim, who's a former member of the Israeli army and a historian at the University of at Oxford College in the UK, said, you know, here you have basically the oppressed who are getting sanctions put on them, and the oppressors are the ones who are imposing the sanctions with support of the international community. Israel has put a siege on Gaza for many years. The rockets are not justified, in my view, but they're in many ways a response to these intolerable situation and the human condition in Gaza, with increasing malnutrition, hunger, and then the bombings take out not only targets, military targets. They're taking out schools. They're taking out refugee shelters. They're taking out power plants, and many more civilians have died than alleged combatants or combatants themselves. So this situation continued all the way through up until 2014. And in 2014, Hamas was no longer in control of its destiny to the extent it had been a little bit earlier, because Iran, Egypt, and Syria, for all different political and military reasons, had essentially withdrawn or sharply reduced their support to Hamas. And Hamas was desperate. And they came to Fatah again for a reconciliation agreement. And they agreed to conditions they never would have agreed to before because of the reality, the political, geopolitical reality. And they basically were not quite on their knees, but basically saying, you know, we will give over all this power to Fatah, which will essentially run this coalition government. This was an amazing opportunity for Israel and the U.S. And the answer, again, this time from the Obama administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu, was war.
Yeah, I mean, this is just so incredible and important to emphasize here, I think, that, you know, what it means that Hamas was willing to sign on from Fatah. If you watch CNN, they'll go, oh, my God, Fatah's getting in bed with Hamas, the terrorists. But what was really going on, as you're saying, is Hamas is saying, okay, you guys take the lead and decide what we're going to do with the UN, decide what we're going to do as far as talking with the Israelis so we can go ahead and get a move on here with, you know, at least preserving the status quo instead of sitting back and watching it just get worse and worse and worse forever.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good piece by Nathan Thrall, who's an analyst with the International Crisis Group and based in Jerusalem, in the New York Times on July 17th, and he says the government could have served Israel's interest. It offered Hamas's political adversaries a foothold in Gaza. It was formed without a single Hamas member. It retained the same Ramallah-based prime minister, deputy prime ministers, finance minister, and foreign minister. And most important, it pledged to comply with the three conditions for Western aid long demanded by America and Europe: nonviolence, adherence to past agreements, and recognition of Israel. And this is an incredible opportunity that was blown, another blown chance to to avoid war in Gaza, and as a result, instead, we have 1,900 Gazans dead. By UN estimates, nearly three-quarters of those civilians.
Yeah, this is that blown implies, you know, an accident, but as you talk about in here, Netanyahu deliberately lied the Israelis into this so-called war.
Yeah, I mean, the war is very popular in Israel, and there are complicated reasons for that. I think a lot of it goes back to how deeply traumatized Israeli society is from the legacy of the Holocaust, that political leaders over the years, including Netanyahu himself, have not been shy to exploit. And that's happened, in my view, in this terrible tragedy as well.
Yeah, but I mean, when you talk about the kidnapping of the boys and the Israeli police and intelligence services knowing good and well they were already dead, but pretending for 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks or so that, oh, yeah, we're going to negotiate with Hamas and oh, we know it was Hamas and all of this stuff in order to beat the drums and then even strikes on the 6th before the rocket attacks of the 7th in Gaza.
Yeah. I mean, there are strong indications, as you say, that they knew well in advance that these teenagers tragically had already been murdered. But what that indicates is what they were really wanting and looking for was a pretext to crush Hamas. By some reports, only 10% of those interrogated, the 400-some people who were interrogated, and many of them later put into Israeli jails without charge or due process, only 10% of them were actually questioned about the abductions of the teenagers. What this indicates is that they were out to crush Hamas and crush the Unity Agreement. And the irony is, the Unity Agreement ain't dead.
Right. Yeah, all of it, basically. And they didn't really accomplish their goals. They didn't even want to overthrow Hamas, and they didn't.
Yeah, and Hamas, you know, just like Hezbollah in 2006 when Israel pledged to crush it, you know, they may emerge stronger than before.
Which, in a twisted way, would also serve the Israelis' purpose, that they can keep playing the how can we deal with people like this? There's no one to talk to, you know, ad infinitum.
Yeah. Well, you know, what my hope is that eventually the U.S. will come to understand that this kind of absolute, unquestioning backing of a military alliance with Israel is not in the United States people's interests, and that we need to question this sort of absolute refusal to recognize that the rights of people to live and to live in freedom should not be trumped by domestic political considerations that don't even take into account the U.S.'s own true interests.
Right. All right, well, we're already over time, but thank you so much for your time, Sandy. I sure appreciate it.
It was really good talking to you, Scott.
Good interview, great article, too, and we'll be, again, posting it tomorrow, everybody, on antiwar.com. Thanks again.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Again, the article is going wild in the Gaza War. It'll be under Tom Engelhardt's name tomorrow, but you know how it is, Tom, with his intro essays, which are great, but it's Sandy Tolan's article here. Going Wild in the Gaza War, and the book is The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East, and the forthcoming Children of the Stone. Again, tomdispatch.com, antiwar.com. That's it. We're overtime. See you tomorrow.